Preoccupation with the tragedy ended when a special courier arrived from headquarters in St. Louis in response to an urgent appeal from the governor of Texas. Major Comstock, after revealing his purpose to Reed, asked permission to address the officers. "Gentlemen, as you've probably heard, the Texas Rangers are being reactivated for the first time since the end of the late war. They're needed because that damned bandit Benito Garza has been chewing up American settlements along the Rio Grande. They need our help." Wetzel, as a professional soldier, growled, "If you listen to the Texans, their Rangers can defeat anybody. Why do they need us?" Comstock had a reply so convoluted that these professionals gasped in wonder at its fatuity. "Garza holds up on the Mexican side of the river. The U.S. Army can't touch him. From that sanctuary, he makes sorties into the United States, robbing and killing. If we catch him over here, of course we can kill him. But we cannot chase him if he escapes to Mexico, forbidden by international law. Absolutely forbidden by Washington." "Then why are we going?" Wetzel asked. "To support the Rangers. They can cross the river. Not being legally a part of our forces, they can pursue the bandits in what they're calling hot pursuit, that is, in the heat of battle." Reed broke in. "So our troops are to protect the American side while the Rangers go after them?" "Precisely. And that's all you're to do. Because if you invade Mexico to get him, you become bandits, just like him." For 2 hours, Comstock reviewed this unusual situation, placing before the restless officers so many ramifications that Wetzel snapped, "Hell, this sounds like our border with Indian territory. The Comanche sneak in and kill, then dart back across the border and claim immunity." "Exactly. But in Garza's case, it's even more complex, because a foreign power is involved." Now the question became, whom to send? And Reed pointed out that with the deaths of young Toomey at Three Cairns and Logan at the tank, plus the disabling injury to Minor, his staff was pretty well depleted, especially in the cavalry. "What about this Lieutenant Renfro?" "Desk duty, Washington. Can't seem to pry him loose." "One of those," Comstock said with disgust, and no more was needed. Finally, both Reed and Comstock agreed that the ideal man for the assignment was Wetzel. And when this was decided, the courier asked that he meet with Reed and Wetzel alone. As they sat in Reed's stone house, the major was blunt. "Captain Wetzel, I've heard only the highest praise for your military prowess, but this is an assignment fraught with danger. Can you be trusted to take your men right up to the edge of the Rio Grande and keep them there, regardless of provocation, until you catch Garza on our side of the river?" "Yes, sir." "None of this hot pursuit?" "No, sir. Here on this northern border of Texas, we learn discipline." "Captain Wetzel, on this border, you have hundreds of observers to report if you stray. On the southern border, you have only yourself to enforce the rules." "Sir, I'm an army captain. I'm also a Prussian. I've been trained to obey orders." "And you understand those orders?" "I do. No soldier under my command will step 1 inch into Mexico." "Good. I want it in writing." And while Reed watched, Comstock took from his papers an order prepared in St. Louis, stating that the officer who endorsed it would allow no excursions into Mexico. The signing was as solemn an undertaking as Wetzel had ever participated in, and when he finished, he saluted. Comstock resumed. "Now, as to your mounted scouts, they'll have to be black, of course." "We'll send Company R," Reed said. "But the only officer we can spare is that chinless wonder Asperson they just sent us from West Point." When Wetzel groaned, Reed added, "But this big Sergeant Jaxifer, he'll more than make up." Next morning, reveille sounded at half an hour before dawn, and when the files were mounted and Reed had delivered a farewell address wishing his men well, Major Comstock, astride a black stallion, motioned Wetzel aside and shared with him certain verbal orders which moved this expedition into its proper military framework. He chose his words carefully, for upon them would hang the reputations of many officers. "General Sheridan commanded me to tell whoever led the troops to the Rio Grande that he must not, repeat not, cross into Mexico." I endorsed that order. But he told me further that this officer would be responsible for the honor of the United States, and that, in extremity, the officer must follow the highest traditions of the army, as he interprets them, on the spot. As the sun rose above the buildings of Fort Garner, the two officers saluted. Petzl's force consisted of 48 infantry, plus a truncated company of Buffalo soldiers, a tough, experienced, well-disciplined group of men. Their path to where Benito Garza was raiding was compass south, then a slight veer toward San Antonio, and another slight jog east toward the small riverfront town of Bravo, where headquarters would be established at Fort Grimm and where contact would be made with the Texas Rangers. On the trip south, only one problem arose. Petzl still did not like black soldiers and found it impossible to be congenial with them, but he did try to be fair. However, no matter what decision had to be made, the black troops knew that invariably they got the worst location for their tents, the poorest food, and the most grudging amenities. The situation was exacerbated by the poor performance of their young officer, Lieutenant Asperson, scion of an old New England family that had prevailed upon their cousin, a senator from Massachusetts, to get the boy into West Point, and upon graduation, an assignment in some post of importance. The authorities, irritated by such pressures, had assured Senator Asperson that his nephew would get one of the finest duty stations, and had then sent him to Fort Garner, one of the most dangerous. Armstrong Asperson was an awkward, inept, stoop-shouldered fellow who should have worn a frown to reflect his inability to adjust to the normal world. Instead, regardless of what disaster overtook him, and he was prone to disasters, he grinned vacuously and with a startling show of teeth. Did it rain when his men had no ponchos? He grinned. Did Petzl give him his daily chewing out? He grinned. After he had been at the fort for about a week, he went down to Sud's Row for his laundry, and one of the toughest washerwomen summarized him in words which ricocheted about the station. They hung the clock on the wall, but forgot two of the parts. So young Asperson, with two parts missing, was heading for his first battle, and both his colonel and his company were aghast to think that soon they might be fighting alongside this grinning scarecrow. Petzl treated him with contempt, and Jaxifer with condescension. "What we got to do, men," he said, "is stay close to him if anything happens, so he don't shoot himself in the foot." Jaxifer, whose entire life had been spent protecting himself from the peculiarities of white bosses, found little difficulty in adjusting either to Vetzel's injustices or to Asperson's inadequacies. Of Petzl he said, "Look, men, he infantry, and he just don't know nothing about cavalry. Keep your mouth shut." Of Asperson, "Remember, even General Grant, he have to start somewhere, but I doubt he start as low as Asperson." Thanks to Jaxifer's counsel, the long march ended without incident. And during the second day in their quarters at Bravo, they met for the first time a Texas Ranger, and they were not impressed. He wore no uniform. In an almost ludicrous manner, he carried, strapped to his saddle, two rifles and four Colts, and nothing about him was army clean. A small, wiry man in his late 40s, he reported to Vetzel's tent, wearing a long white linen duster that came to his ankles. Without saluting, the small, diffident man said, "You, Petzl? I'm McNabb." "You?" Petzl said in unmasked surprise. "I thought you'd be much bigger." "I look bigger when I'm on a horse," McNabb said without smiling. "I'm sure glad to have your help." And without further amenities, he began to draw maps in the sand outside Vetzel's tent. "It's tough down here," McNabb said. "Maybe even tougher than fighting Comanche." "Now that would be pretty tough." "Problem is this Benito Garza. I've known him all my life. He's a lot smarter than me, and, if you'll permit the expression, maybe a lot smarter than most of your men." "I've heard that," Petzl said, displaying a professional interest in a military situation. "How does he operate?" "Clever as a possum," McNabb said, and he let his explanation end as the cook beat upon a ring signaling supper. While Betzel smoked his cigar at sunset, McNab resumed his map drawing. Garza waits till something happens on this side of the border, and things do happen. Like hanging Mexican landowners? Mexicans ask for hanging, McNab said. But when it happens, Garza feels he must retaliate, and he does. In the same region? McNab looked about for a blade of grass, found one, and chewed on it. Now, there's the problem. Always he confuses us. 4 times in a row, he strikes within a mile of where some Mexican was hanged. Next time, 50 miles away. How can you anticipate? McNab chewed on his grass, then confessed, "We can't." There was a long silence. Then, as darkness approached from the east, McNab said quietly, "Captain Betzel, let me tell you what's going on now. Proceed." "We have good reason to think that Garza has taken command of a ranch, El Solitario, about 10 miles south of here. He has 40, 50 men there, and they fan out to execute their revenge up and down the river." No one spoke. More than 2 minutes passed without a word, for each of the 3 men attending the meeting knew what McNab was proposing. That he and his rangers cross the Rio Grande, make a sudden descent upon the hidden ranch, shoot Garza, and rely upon the United States Army to support them as they beat a frantic retreat with 40 or 50 well-mounted Mexican riders striving to overtake them. Still silent, McNab drew in the sand the location of Bravo, the river, the distant location of Rancho El Solitario, plus the circuitous route to it, and the short, frenzied retreat back to the Rio Grande. When everything was in place, he said softly, "It could be done." Bluntly, Betzel scuffed his foot along the escape route. "You mean if someone came along here to hold off your pursuers?" "Couldn't be done otherwise." Betzel leaned back, folded his arms like an irritated German schoolmaster, and said, "I have the strictest orders forbidding me to step 1 inch onto Mexican soil." "I'm sure you do," McNab said quietly. "But what if my 16 rangers came down that road you just scratched out, with 50 Mexicans sure to overtake us before we reached the river? I would have my men lined up on this side of the river, every gun at the ready. Sergeant Girton and a Gatling gun would be prepared to rake the river if the Mexicans tried to invade this side, and I would pray for you." "Would you allow your men to come to the middle of the river to help?" "Is that the boundary between the 2 countries?" "It is." "My best gunners would be there." Now came the time for a direct question. "But you wouldn't come into Mexico to help?" "Absolutely not." That ended the consultation. So without showing his disappointment, McNab rode back to his own camp upriver. And it was unfortunate that he went in that direction, because downriver some recent arrivals from Tennessee slew 4 Mexicans trying to prevent illegal seizure of their ancestral ranch land. Next morning, about noon, Otto McNab was back to consult with Betzel. "I'm sure Garza will strike within the next 3 days, but where? Do you think we should scatter our forces?" "I really don't know. If he starts out now, within 3 days he could be almost anywhere. Since spies must have informed him of your arrival, he'll hit somewhere near here to shame you. So we should stay put." "I think so." Garza, infuriated by the killing of peasants trying to protect land once owned by his mother, Trinidad de Saldana, was grimly determined to let the intruders know that this fight was going to be interminable, and, as McNab had predicted, he could do this most effectively by striking close to the new encampment. He allowed 5 days to lapse, then 6, then 7, so that the rangers and the soldiers would be disoriented. On the night of the 8th day, he rode with 30 of his best men across the Rio Grande and devastated 2 ranches east of Bravo, killing 3 Texans and escaping to safety before either the rangers or the soldiers could be alerted. He took his men on a wide swing back to the safety of El Solitario. This nest of adobe houses was completely surrounded by a high stone and adobe wall, which enclosed fruit trees, a well, and enough cattle to feed his men for more than a month. It was a frontier ranch, so built as to protect its inhabitants from assaults coming from any direction. But its major asset was that it lay far enough inland from the river to make an attack from Texas unlikely. McNabb did not think it was impregnable. Informers tell us Garza did the job downriver with no more than 30 men, who are now holed up at his ranch with about 20 others. I'm going in there and finish Benito Garza. He spoke these words not to Wetzel, but to his rangers, 16 of them, the youngest only 16 years old. Then he added, I do not order any of you to come with me, but I'm inviting volunteers. As two men stepped forward, he stopped them. You know, I've been after Garza for 30 years. I've made it my life's work. I have to go. You don't. I want him too, a thin, fierce Texan said. He killed my brother. Every ranger volunteered, but the boy, he turned back. No, Sam, it wouldn't be fair. I'm here because he burned our ranch. Well, you stay behind and lead the troops when they come to rescue us. They said they wouldn't do that. That's what they said, but they'll come. Lead them to that fork we saw on our last scout. When the boy showed his disappointment, McNabb asked, You remember where the fork is? We'll be coming there, hell for leather. Have the soldiers in position to do us some good. He took off his duster, folded it neatly, and stowed it. His men placed beside it things they did not care to risk on this adventure. And when everyone was ready, McNabb took out his watch and handed it to the boy, instructing him as to how it should be used. At 5 that afternoon, Captain McNabb and his rangers forded the Rio Grande, rode north, then cut into heavy mesquite. Through the night, they moved cautiously toward Garza's ranch. But at half an hour before sunup, they had the bad luck to be spotted by Mexicans living on a smaller ranch. There was some noise and a scattering of chickens, after which a young man shouted, Rinches! Men started running for their horses, but each was shot before he could mount. There would be no messenger riding forth from this ranch. And to ensure that no woman tried to spread the alarm, all horses in the corral were shot, and rangers bound the four remaining women and locked them in a room. It was nearly dawn when McNabb's men reached the high walls of the Garza compound, and now a brief council of war was held, not to devise tactics, for they had been agreed upon days before, but to specify tasks. At a signal, four rangers crashed through the main gate, paving the way for the rest to follow. There was a blaze of gunfire, and then in the doorway appeared the white-haired figure of Benito Garza, his two pistols drawn, ready for battle. McNabb, who had anticipated such an appearance, steadied his rifle against a watering trough, and for a second recalled that similar moment on the eve of the battle at Buena Vista, when through gallantry he had allowed Garza to escape. And he saw also that incredible scene in 1848, when Garza had passed by him within inches during the escape of Santa Anna into exile. Not this time, Uncle Benito, he muttered, as Garza started to leave the doorway. The heavy bullet sped straight to the heart, and the great bandit, protector of his people, lurched forward, expecting to see his ancient enemy in some shadow. But he saw nothing, and toppled to his death. Away, McNabb shouted, and according to plan, three of the rangers tried to shoot the Mexican horses, but failed. In a wild exit, during which one of the daring Texans was picked off, 15 rangers, including McNabb, made their escape from within the high walls and started their ride of desperation toward the river. At 4 o'clock that morning, the 16-year-old ranger began looking at Captain McNabb's watch, and at 4:30 he followed instructions. Galloping his horse past the sentries, he pulled up at Captain Wetzel's tent and shouted, The rangers are attacking El Solitario. When? Wetzel cried as he left his tent, with a sheet about his shoulders. Right now. Why wasn't I warned? I am warning you. Captain McNabb told me. Tell him at 4:30. I don't want him to worry all night. Bugler, sound assembly. And in the darkness, Wetzel mustered his men, ordering them into full battle gear. "Are we going across to help?" Sergeant Gurton asked, and Wetzel said, "No." At dawn, he mounted his black charger and rode about supervising the placement of his troops, putting his best sharpshooters along the American bank of the Rio Grande. He personally directed Gurton and his two men where to place their Gatling gun to command the crossing. He called for volunteers to wade out into the shallow river and point their guns to where the fleeing rangers would probably appear. And then he rode to where his buffalo soldiers were encamped, some distance from the white troops. Almost contemptuously, he dismissed Lieutenant Asperson with a curt order. "Take half your company and guard that other crossing." Then he rode to where Sergeant Jaxifer waited with 10 mounted troopers and started this crucial conversation. "Wetzel, you know what's happening over there?" Jaxifer, "I can guess." "Wetzel, you know my orders?" Jaxifer, "Yes, sir." "Wetzel, when those rangers come galloping to that river, what will you and your men do?" Jaxifer, "Wait for orders." "Wetzel, will you be ready to cross and hold back the Mexicans?" Jaxifer, "We ready right now." Wetzel, listening for the sound of gunfire to begin, "I have learned respect for you on this trip, Jaxifer. Why do we have so much trouble with our white infantry and so little with your black cavalry?" Jaxifer, "Because we black?" Wetzel, "What does that mean?" Jaxifer, "You white officers never understand." Wetzel, "Tell me." Jaxifer, "In the whole United States, ain't nothing a black man can hope for half as good as being in the Buffalo Soldiers. Black men's dream of this. They pray. They do almost anything for white men's just to get in the 10th Cavalry. I'm the biggest black man in Texas because I'm a sergeant in the 10th. Colonel Wetzel, I will die rather than lose that job." Wetzel, "Why didn't you tell me this before?" Jaxifer, "Because it's our secret. We ain't never before had honor, but we got it now, and we will not risk it." Wetzel, "What does that mean to me this morning?" Jaxifer, "Without orders from you, we don't move. With orders, we'll ride to Mexico City or die trying." Wetzel, "Everything ready?" Jaxifer, "When you sent Asperson away, I kept the best men with me. We all want to be on the far side of that river." Wetzel, "If the Mexicans make one wrong move, I'll lead you." Jaxifer, "We hungry to go." The two men remained astride their horses, immobilized by the great traditions of their army. Jaxifer desperately wanted to lead his men in a charge to rescue the white fighters. That was the whole purpose of his cavalry and the reason for his being in uniform. But he could not move, even though the rangers died, unless he had an order. And Captain Wetzel, who had followed soldiering since a boy in both Germany and America, longed for battle. He loved it, loved the excitement of the chase, the fury of the sudden explosion when armies met. But he had unmistakable orders to refrain unless the United States was invaded. But then the secret words of Major Comstock echoed. "The officer will be expected to follow the highest traditions of the army." That had to mean the rescue of fellow Americans in danger, and for such action he was more than prepared. Spurring his horse toward the river, with Jaxifer following, he turned and said, "I hope those Mexicans make one mistake, fire one bullet into our territory." The tangled reflections of the two impatient soldiers were broken by the appearance of the young ranger. "Where are you going?" Wetzel asked, and the boy replied, "To lead the niggers to where the trails meet." "Who told you to do that?" "Captain McNabb. He was sure that when you heard gunfire, you'd send them, no matter what your orders said." Disgusted by this unprofessional behavior on the part of the rangers, and wishing to rid himself of the boy, Wetzel growled, "They're down there," indicating the other crossing, where lanky Lieutenant Asperson sat grinning with a smaller group of buffalo soldiers. While Wetzel and Jaxifer were agonizing over their alternatives, Otto McNabb and his rangers were in full retreat, fighting a rearguard action of desperation. And they might have escaped without help from the hesitant soldiers had not a daring Mexican bandit, accompanied by 6 others, known of a shortcut to the river. Pounding down its narrow turns, these determined men reached a point on the escape route just before McNabb, and a furious gun battle raged, forcing the Rangers to move downriver from their planned route. This threw them onto a trail which would bring them to the lesser crossing of the Rio Grande, guarded by the lesser Black Cavalry. And as the Rangers and their pursuers approached the river, Asperson could hear the sound of gunfire. Excited by the likelihood of his first battle, he started his buffalo soldiers toward the river, then stopped them in obedience to the orders he had memorized. The young ranger, watching with dismay as the rescue operation halted, pulled a clever trick. Throwing a sharp pebble at Asperson's horse, he made the horse rear, and the nervous lieutenant cried in a high voice, "My God, we're under attack!" Consulting no one, waiting for no verification, he waved his revolver in the air as if it were a sword and shouted, "To the rescue!" For him, there was no anxiety, no nagging moral problem. Americans were under attack by foreigners, and by God, he was going to do something about it. With a roar, his black troops followed. During the disorganized charge, in which black cavalrymen passed and repassed their ungainly leader, he did retain enough control to order the bugler to sound charge so that the beleaguered Rangers would know of their coming. Because of the uneven terrain, the bugle kept slipping from the bugler's lips, but the broken sounds did reach the battle area, giving the Rangers hope and throwing their pursuers into confusion. McNabb said later, "The buffalo soldiers came roaring out of the mesquite like six different armies. They were a mob, but they were magnificent." The confused battle, more like a riot, really, lasted only a few minutes. Not many Mexicans were killed, and no Americans. But when it was over, McNabb and Asperson rode like Roman victors down to the Rio Grande, and as they splashed their horses into that shallow, muddy stream, the regular army on the American side went berserk. The advance guard, standing in the river, fired indiscriminately. Sergeant Girton and his Gatling gun sprayed the empty Mexican shore. The others cheered, and Wetzel looked on in amazement. By 10 that morning, he had a telegram started on its way to headquarters. "In obedience, highest traditions, U.S. Army, 10th Cavalry, 2nd Lieutenant Asperson, under attack by Mexican bandits, retaliated with great gallantry. Stop. Benito Garza, dead. 1 Ranger casualty. No army, many Mexican." When Sergeant Jaxifer read his men a copy of this precious verification of the victory, one of his troopers said, "Can't understand. They tell me McNabb just kill his best friend, but he act like nothing happened. Look." And the cavalryman watched as McNabb unfolded his white linen duster, threw it about his shoulders, and started that day's routine. With Captain Wetzel and Lieutenant Asperson absent on detached duty along the Rio Grande, Fort Garner was hurting for officers. And what made the deficiency most painful was that clever Louis Renfro still malingered in Washington. In some anger, Captain Reed dispatched an urgent appeal to St. Louis. "Fort Garner has acute need services, 1st Lieutenant Louis Renfro, Brevet Colonel, currently on detached duty, Washington." In the Capitol, there was a good deal of dickering with Congress before Renfro could be released for active duty, because both he and his wife pulled strings to prevent him from being moved out of his socially pleasing job as liaison with the omnipotent Quartermaster Corps. Mrs. Renfro was especially effective in this campaign, for she knew several senators and representatives on the military committees, and she lobbied to keep her husband in the Capitol. "Senator, you served during the late war. You know that speeding supplies to the troops, it wins many a battle." Since she was pretty as well as clever, her arguments were almost irresistible. But when a gruff colonel who had behaved with distinction at both Gettysburg and the Wilderness presented the congressional committee with the record of Lieutenant Renfro, they had to pay attention. "Gentlemen, since that day at Appomattox, your Lieutenant Renfro has been constantly assigned to battle stations on the frontier. That's a period of 7 years. And during that time, he has maneuvered detached desk assignments for all but 5 weeks. Renfro is another fighting man who never fights." One senator, who had been impressed by Mrs. Renfro's defense of her husband, asked, "But doesn't he make a crucial contribution here, assuring your men their supplies?" The colonel refrained from pointing out that anyone with a fifth-grade education could do as well, Instead, he made a clever observation. "Senator, I am not for 1 minute denigrating Renfro's enviable record in the late war. I am thinking only of his career." "What do you mean?" "Unless he can show on his record proof of command in the field, how can he ever be promoted to the high rank which every fighting man aspires to? If he doesn't include active duty in a position of importance, he can never become general." Such argument made sense to the congressman with military records, and shortly thereafter, Renfro received orders to report at once to his assigned Company S, 10th Cavalry at Fort Sam Garner on the Texas frontier, to serve under the command of Captain George Reed, Brevet Brigadier General. When Daisy Renfro heard the doleful news, she stormed. "A nigger regiment! It scars a man for life! Lewis, you will not be in that fort 6 weeks, I promise. We did it before, we can do it again." And she started immediately the intense campaign to recall her husband to his preferred job in Washington. Before the Renfros had time to report, two inspection teams visited Fort Garner, for the Army feared that something fundamental might be wrong at this lonely command. Newspaper stories had begun asking questions which had to be answered. The first visit came from regimental headquarters at Fort Sill, and it was led by one of the splendid, tragic figures of the Civil War. Benjamin Grierson, a Pennsylvania farm boy, had been serving as an underpaid music teacher in Illinois when the late war started. Distrustful of horses, after having been kicked in the face by one, he protested when assigned to a cavalry unit, of which he became the commander. Soon thereafter, finding no one else eligible, the quiet music teacher was summoned for a most difficult and dangerous mission. "We must prevent the Confederates from moving reinforcements to the defense of Vicksburg. Take your troops as a raiding party. Move behind enemy lines on the east bank of the Mississippi and disrupt communications as much as possible." With no fixed headquarters and no reliable supply, the 37-year-old music teacher ran wild for 16 days, always on the verge of capture by superior Confederate forces, always on hand at some surprising moment to wreck a train or burn a stores depot. He fought innumerable small battles, fleeing always to some new position from which to make his next assault. At the conclusion of these incredible raids, his men reported, 1,700 of us rode 600 miles behind enemy lines, losing only 3 killed, 9 missing. We killed about 100 of the enemy, captured and paroled over 500, destroyed more than 60 miles of railroad, captured 3,000 stand of arms, and took over 1,000 mules and horses. Grierson had been a military phenomenon, an untrained layman who intuitively understood the most subtle arts of mounted warfare. His men loved him, for they knew him to be both lucky and brave, an irresistible combination, and he achieved a much greater success in the backwoods of Mississippi and Louisiana than more notable cavalry commanders like Jeb Stuart did in the East. He was one of the foremost cavalry commanders in American history, and as a consequence, he had risen to the rank of brevet general. But when peace came, he faced the unalterable opposition of all West Point officers, who leveled 4 charges against him. He was a civilian. He was a music teacher. On the Texas frontier, he tried to treat Indians as if they were honorable opponents like Frenchmen or Englishmen. And he was soiled by being personally responsible for the black troops of the 10th Cavalry, an unacceptable command with which he would be stuck for 22 years. Grierson was a talented man, a true genius, and he suffered the contempt of his fellow officers without complaint. He did believe that if Indians were treated justly, they could be brought into full citizenship. And he did defend the bravery and competency of his Negro troops, for he knew from frontier reports how well the latter performed under fire. It was headquarters that did not believe. Most critically, it was the newspapers in Texas that deplored having Negro troops protecting the Texas frontier. Their attacks were savage. "We need no niggers here. Give us 50 Rangers, and we can clear the plains all the way to California." When General Grierson, his brevet rank honored along the frontier, arrived at Fort Garner, he was 46, still lean, still alert. He was stigmatized immediately by the Prussian Wetzel, back from the Rio Grande, as a man deficient in discipline, one of those weaklings who try to rule by the affection of troops rather than by rigorous command. And Wetzel had watched too many times as such officers came to a bad end. Wetzel, like most of the regulars, held the former music teacher in contempt. The other officers, especially those in the 10th Cavalry, did not. They knew from personal experience that he was a gallant leader who defended the prerogatives of his men and who led them to one quiet success after another. Some actually loved him for the legendary heroics he had performed during the war. But most of the infantry officers and men, who could not believe what this quiet man had accomplished, dismissed him as another eccentric leader of colored troops. In a tremendously concentrated half-day, General Grierson satisfied himself on many points, which he stated in the report he wrote that night. At the Battle of Three Cairns, units of the 10th Cavalry deported themselves according to the highest traditions of the service. Second Lieutenant Elmer Toomey directed his men properly and died gallantly at their head. First Sergeant John Jaxifer assumed command as expected and defended an exposed position with valor. I can give no credence to charges made by the Cabin and Clark drivers that Sergeant Jaxifer was in any way deficient. This battle will shine brightly among the laurels gained by this regiment. The death of Second Lieutenant Jim Logan, one of our most accomplished horsemen from Ireland, and the scandal attaching thereto, is the kind of tragedy which can overtake any unit of any kind, civilian or military. I treasured Logan as a brave man, and I mourn his death. In all respects, I find these units of the 10th Cavalry in good condition, battle-ready and well-led. Their desertion rate is 1 in 300. Desertion rate of the white troops at the fort, 48 in 100 over a period of 4.5 years. I especially commend these enlisted men who serve so faithfully and with such enthusiasm, and I applaud Captain Reed's leadership, finding nothing to censure. On the next day, General Grierson reviewed his troops, and then asked Sergeant Jaxifer to lead him out to where Jim Logan and Johnny Miner's wife had died. Jaxifer told his men later, "General, when he see the spot, and the water, and the birds, he dismounts and stands by the spot weeping. I stayed clear, but he motioned me to dismount, and together we placed some stones. 2 good men," he said a couple times, meaning Logan and Miner. He never mentioned Miss Nellie. That night the Reeds held a gala for the visitors, and one of the Mexicans whom the soldiers employed to work the horses appeared with a violin. One of the laundresses beat a tambourine, and there was dancing, and the best food possible purchased from the post sutler, and much conversation about the old days. Even Wetzel relaxed, telling of his unit's exploits at various battles, and it was General this and Colonel that, as if the old ranks still pertained, as if the old salary scale were still being paid, instead of the miserly pay accorded these heroic veterans. Once a lieutenant colonel, now a first lieutenant, $1,500 a year. Once a general, now a captain, $1,800 a year. Grierson was at his best, even joking with Dürr Hermann Wetzel. "Your boys over in Prussia are going to conquer all Europe one of these days," to which Wetzel replied, "They will certainly conquer France." That night Reed could not sleep, and when his wife heard his restless turning, she asked why, and he said, "My mother was an educated woman, you know, and she made us memorize poetry. She taught us that the finest single line comes at the end of Milton's sonnet to his dead wife." "I don't know that," Louise said. "The first 13 lines tell of how the blind poet dreams that she has come back from the grave to speak with him. Love, sweetness, goodness in her person shined. That was my mother, too. But then came the 14th line, and everything fell apart. Mother said its 10 short words were arrows pointed at the heart, showing what blindness meant. I waked, she fled, and day brought back my night." They lay in the darkness for some time, and then the general sighed deeply, making the anguish of his thought echo through the room. Tonight I was a general once more. Tomorrow the bugles will sound, dawn will break, and I shall be a captain again. And forever. The second investigating team was completely different. Lieutenant General Philip Sheridan, a marvelously concentrated Irishman with a bullet head and drooping walrus mustaches. A sort of roundish, ineffectual-looking man until one discovered that every bulge was muscle, rode into the fort with three of his pet colonels, men, he said, of infinite promise. Most powerful was Ranald Mackenzie, a man so intense, said his troops, that his eyes could cut rocks. He was destined to leapfrog his contemporaries and stand at the threshold of commander-in-chief until his mind snapped, destroyed by syphilis and by the burdens he had placed upon it. There was Nelson Miles, not a West Point man, but something much better, the nephew by marriage of both General William Tecumseh Sherman, head of the army, and Senator John Sherman, the powerful political leader from Ohio. He was an unproved quantity at the threshold of his career, but with his uncle's help he would gain constant promotion. A vain, arrogant, impossible man, with only one credit to his name. He was a phenomenally brave officer when leading men into battle. Most impressive, to men and women alike, was Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, nearly 6 feet tall, never weighing more than 170, and of such elegant bearing that he commanded attention wherever he went. Like the other two, he was 34, but he was totally unlike them in other respects. They wore ordinary military uniforms, well pressed and tended. He wore custom-tailored trousers and jacket, spats over his General Quimper boots, and a remarkable Russian-type greatcoat cut from a heavy French cloth, and with a monstrous cape adorned with Afghanistan caracal fur at the neck, along the front and at the cuffs. His face was cadaverously thin, with romantic hollows under his cheekbones, and he was obviously worried about the gradual retreat of his hair, for like many vain men, he twisted and trained it to lie across his forehead and hide the loss. At the neck, he wore his hair very long, and since it was naturally wavy, enhanced by his wife's constant attention with hot irons, it added considerably to his appeal. Like most officers of that period, he wore a mustache, which he kept so carefully trimmed that it added dignity to a face already as compelling as that of any Roman emperor. They were, as both Sherman and Sheridan agreed, three remarkable young colonels, and it was inevitable that one of them would gain supreme command. Mackenzie, perhaps the ablest of the three, would be disqualified because of creeping insanity. Custer would perish because of his inexcusable arrogance at the Little Bighorn. Miles, the political conniver, would prevail. In the military, as in all human endeavor, it can sometimes be the man who merely survives who triumphs, whether his skills warrant it or not. Sheridan and his three aces needed little time to assess the situation at Fort Garner. Second rate in every respect. When a wife misbehaves like Nellie Miner, she should be soldiered out within the day. When an important supply train approaches, it should be protected by more than an untested second lieutenant. And when an Indian marauder like Matark ravages a countryside, he should be caught and hanged. Captain Reed is moderately acceptable, but the only officer present who seems to have an understanding of what a frontier fort should be is Captain Hermann Wetzel, who is hereby commended for his attention to detail. No formal rebuke was leveled against Captain Reed, but a kind of sorrow suffused the visit, as if the young colonels regretted that he was not a better man. Colonel Custer went out of his way to applaud Mrs. Reed's handling of the Johnny Miner affair, and he spellbound the other wives with his graciousness and warmth of understanding. When Sheridan led his team away, the fort continued under the aura of the three colonels, and there was much discussion as to which one would triumph in the battle for promotion. Wetzel summarized opinions. Miles is political, but very strong in the field, a powerful combination. Custer can achieve anything if he attends to details. Mackenzie's the one I'd like to lead me into battle. The women did not bother with the credentials of the other two colonels. Custer is magnificent. And he was, for he was considerate, charming, persistent, and suffused with that glamour which can only be called romantic. Even their husbands could not denigrate him when their wives applauded, for he was unquestionably the most dramatic leader ever to have visited Fort Garner, and his heavy felt spats and fur-trimmed greatcoat would long be remembered.